This is Beyond the Black Stump, a new podcast for the risk resilience and continuity community. This show will offer ideas about leadership and learning that can help remove some of the limitations we place on ourselves and our own thinking. Welcome to episode 3 of the show. My name is Ken Simpson. This episode is one I was really looking forward to recording. I wanted to start the show with some fresh ideas and a relatively new voice, which is why I chose Luke Bird. The focus should be the future and how we have to change to accommodate a new generation. But it was also important for me to balance that perspective from the start. And my guest today will certainly challenge you to think about different perspectives. He is one of the old hands in this industry, with almost 20 years in practice. He came to the resilience professions with a considerable experience as a manager and entrepreneur. He is a passionate and fearless advocate and one of the most compelling speakers you will find on the international conference circuit. So come along for the ride. And be prepared to hear uncomfortable ideas, because Nathaniel Forbes is regularly thinking beyond the black stump. So, Nat Forbes, good to speak with you and welcome to the show. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So, we met for the first time in Phoenix just recently after quite some time of exchanging emails. But unfortunately, in these conferences, you never seem to get enough time to ask all the questions of people that you meet. So yeah. Thank you for coming on and sharing. Can I start by getting you to talk a bit about yourself? I'm sure that's a subject you don't get asked to speak about very often, but you've had this quite fascinating career. Looking at your CV, you've been a sales manager, so you've got that experience with profit center responsibility. You've been a pioneer of online lodgement in the US. So how the hell does that get someone to coming into business continuity as an industry?
Dumb luck. Some people who had invested in my startup company referred me to some fellows who operated a disaster recovery site in Singapore in the mid-1990s, and they needed some help. So I went to look it over and report back what I thought the company in the United States should do. They took my advice. I stayed in Singapore. The company didn't do as well as I did. The company went bankrupt, leaving me in Singapore with all my belongings in a shipping container in the middle of the Pacific, and no company, no employer, no work permit, and no place to live. And fortunately, I remembered that I was an entrepreneur, and so I took over. I started a company in Singapore in 1996. To do business continuity planning. At the time, most people in Asia couldn't spell BCP, let alone have any idea what it was. 19 years later, it paid for two kids to go to college and provided employment for a fairly substantial number of people in Singapore, and I had a great run.
Oh, that's so really, you came into business continuity by actually having to practice it for yourself.
I had my first disaster recovery project was recovering from having no place to live or work. That's correct.
That's probably one of the most unusual. I mean, people coming into the industry by dumb luck or being dropped in it is pretty normal, I think, for our generation. But yeah, having to do it because of your own continuity problems is unusual. That background as an entrepreneur obviously shaped why you got into this in the first place, but that coming into the business with management experience. I'm not talking about managing people per se, but having to manage profit center and total accountability for a business, and having been an entrepreneur, did that shape the way you look at the practice?
I didn't think that was the question you're going to ask me. If you asked me the question, did it affect the way I tried to run my business? Very much so. Did it affect the way I practiced business continuity? Not at all. I didn't know what business continuity was. I was reading two chapters ahead of my customer when I first started out. It definitely affected the way I managed the company. I was greatly affected in the 1990s by a book called In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters. I believed in the concept of management by wandering around, which he promoted. I felt that the most important thing I could do was to treat people who worked for me well, knowing that it would be very difficult to find people who had any experience at all in business continuity 20 years ago. And so therefore I was going to have to grow them myself. And if I was going to make that kind of investment in them, I wanted to be sure they stuck around.
Yeah, it's again, a different concept. We don't get a lot of conversation about Tom Peters and a lot of the management principles when we talk to BC people. So
yeah,
I'm already seeing a different trend emerge. You've also, while you were in Singapore, spent many, many years as the president of the Emergency Management Association in Asia. Tell me, why the Emergency Management Association? Was that just the only thing, game in town, or why did you go with that one?
Two factors came together at once. I had a colleague, somebody who worked with me, who was, so far as I know, the first certified emergency manager by the International Association of Emergency Managers, the IAEM, in Asia. And he was encouraging me to get involved with IAEM. And the second thing, I realized that having some expertise in emergency management as opposed to business continuity provided an important competitive advantage over other consultants in Asia who focused on business continuity management for banks. And I got involved with IAEM because those two factors came together, and I got involved quite heavily. I became an officer of the organization and a board member of the international organization. I spent a number of years trying to build up the organization in Asia. I ran a conference there in 2010 that was pretty well received. But I think in retrospect, there is no culture of emergency management in any of the 28 countries of Asia where our organization recruited members. In the United States, every county, there's 40,000 counties in the United States, and all 40,000 of them are by law required to have somebody who's responsible for emergency management. Where you live in Australia, emergency management, the SES, all that kind of stuff is sort of ingrained into the way public services run. That is not true in the in Asia. And I found that it was very difficult to describe to people what emergency management was, explain why I thought it could be a professional practice, why it could be a career for some people. And today I think that IAEM is struggling in Asia, although the organization still exists.
So again, sort of the right man in the right place to try and get something up and running.
Well, I think the IAM people in the U.S. were very happy to have an American that they could talk to, one who had experience, quite a lot of experience in starting up organizations from scratch, and who had a pretty good mailing list. By the time I got involved with them, I had been in Asia for between 10 and 15 years. We had a very large mailing list of people who were at least predisposed to interest in emergency management because of their interests in business continuity. So, yeah, I think it was lucky for me. It was lucky for them. I had a great time. I met a lot of people who are still very good friends. And it did, in fact, provide the competitive advantage that I was looking for. But it's still pushing wet spaghetti uphill in Asia.
Some might say it's similar in a lot of places. So let's sort of move it on to talk about the current state of the industry. When I look at what's going on today, often seems to me we're caught between this whole management systems and certification standards desire on one hand, and on the other hand, we have this desire to label what we do as resilience. How do you see the current state of the nation?
From a high level, really not significantly different than it was 20 years ago when I first started doing this kind of thing. In professions that you're in, that I have been in, that the people we hang out have been in, as a group, I refer to them as the resilience professions, because that's just faster than saying business continuity, emergency management, risk management, crisis management, disaster relief, disaster recovery, disaster management, and security. Every time you want to describe people who are in the business of protecting lives and property, I think that those practices focus in the main on picking up the pieces after an event. Yes, we push quite hard to prepare in advance, but most often we are dealing with people who do not see the value in preparing in advance, either in the public sector or in the private sector. And I became frustrated with pushing that same wet spaghetti uphill after a number of years, and started thinking more about what's the fundamental problem. I decided it's basically 10,000 years of development of the human brain. Our brains have developed for 10,000 years to try and manage the animal instincts that our ancestors had thousands of years ago, that protected them from being eaten by saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths. There's a fight or flight fear, and the human brain has developed over the years in an attempt to control those chemical reactions. So I really have become quite a bit more interested in psychology. One of the questions you had asked me earlier was, or you had sent to me earlier was, what do I think about new threats coming up all the time? I don't see any new threats. I see old threats coming back. I don't think terrorism is new. I don't think earthquakes are new. I don't think tsunamis are new. I think that the number of disease pandemics we're having is new, but disease itself is not new. We're basically playing the same record over and over again. We may be playing it to a new audience. We may have successfully recruited some members of a new generation to become professional emergency managers or professional risk managers, but fundamentally we're still fighting a rear guard action. And I have devoted what remains of my career to focusing on persuasion. What is it that will persuade people to take action in the face of what seem to you and me to be very clear, obvious risks?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? If would you therefore say that there's not a great deal of difference in principle between, say, you know, Jesse James or someone of that era knocking down a telegraph wire and hackers and a distributed denial of service attack on someone today? You're saying it's still a similar threat, it's just the scale of impact that's different.
Scale, perhaps speed of onset is a bit faster. When you can push a button and bring down a network as opposed to having to climb the telephone pole to snip the wire. But fundamentally, there are natural threats, technical threats, and human threats, and the nature of them has not changed much and is not likely to change much. I'm less interested, Ken, these days in power failures and bridges falling down than I am in existential threats to human existence. And they are, for me, water, food, population, disease, and climate. Those are the things that are going to affect large numbers of people. Those are the things that are going to cause social stress, physical stress, financial impact, have significant financial consequences. And I think those issues are particularly difficult for people in traditional resilience professions like business continuity to deal with, because and primarily because their speed of onset is generally very slow. The kind of events that we're accustomed to dealing with are a sudden power failure, a sudden earthquake, a sudden tsunami, even a pandemic, to the extent that we learned something about pandemics in the last decade. The effects of the pandemic, you can see the pandemic coming, but people tend to not do anything about it until the guy next door or the guy at work is sick. That sudden speed of onset makes triggering actions much easier. I know when the power went out because I'm sitting in the dark. How do I know when I should be thinking about water security or food security or climate change or urban concentrations of population? One more person, 10 more people, 500 more people, 1,000, a million. It's very difficult, I think, in our professions, and I'm quite interested in addressing and attacking that conundrum.
It's one of the things that's often interests me about your work is you're thinking about issues that very few other people in the industry are talking about. In 2013, and certainly in preparation for WCDM in 2013, you wrote a document, a post, "What's Wrong with Contingency Planning?"
Yes.
And I quote a little bit from it. "The ways we practice contingency planning today cannot lead to resilience because we can't add value if we don't address the big risks that leaders think about. We don't have all the skills to address them, and we deal with only a small fraction of the full range of consequences." So is that the kind of thinking that led you to addressing those issues? Are those the risks that you're saying leaders are thinking about?
Well, that is the that was my manifesto, and you're correct that I did do that in connection with WCDM 2 years ago. I wouldn't change a word of that. I think it's manifestly obvious to anybody who works in a resilience profession that what he or she does is not sufficient to achieve organizational or social resilience. Business continuity is not enough by itself. Being a first aider is not enough by itself. Being an emergency manager or risk manager is not enough by itself. So the kinds of skills that we have are not enough to address the consequences of the disasters that we are likely to be faced with in the future. The consequences of water insecurity, the consequences of food insecurity, the consequences of disease. I don't know many business continuity managers who even know basic first aid or could save a life if a person fell down in front of them. Does that not seem odd to you that I can run around and say, well, I'm certified in business continuity, but if my wife tips over, my kids tip over, or I'm in a public place and somebody tips over in front of me, I don't have any idea how to help them? That seems incongruous to me. If I'm an expert in organizational resilience, what do I have to contribute in the area to a business that's confronted with running out of water or being put on water restrictions? That issue is a huge issue this minute as we speak in California, and it's only going to become bigger. I guess I probably don't have to tell anybody from Australia about drought.
Absolutely. It's an occupational hazard in much of the country here as well. Mm. So when you have a slogan, resilience is a competitive advantage, you're selling that to executives, but you're selling it as the big picture of resilience. How are you differentiating it from the traditional business continuity risk models? Is it just on the proactive reactive? Is it on the holistic perspective or the strategic tactical or all of those things?
No, I think fundamentally as I said, as I wrote in the piece that you quoted, that there is no commercial advantage to being BCM certified as an organization. And I think that's why organizations have not adopted ISO 22301 with the same with the same interest with which they attacked ISO 9001 10, 15, 20 years ago. If my business is certified to ISO 9001, I'm going to be invited to bid on jobs, and I am going to win jobs. The companies that are not certified to ISO 9001 will not get or will not win. If I'm certified to a societal resilience standard, which is, I think is the terminology for ISO 22301,
correct?
I'm sorry, what do I get? As far as I can tell, all I get is a lot of expense and administrative hassle. And until you can show an executive that by doing things that make an organization better able to cope with uncertainty, I don't think that that the practice of BCM has a future. Right. I've got on my webpage somewhere that in 10 years, business continuity managers will have gone the way of directory assistance operators for telephone companies. They provide a service, but nobody needs it and nobody wants it. So instead, what I focus on in my own practice, limited as it is and winding down as it is does the investment of time or money make commercial sense to a business? That is, you're not building a disaster recovery site. Now, let me try to find a better example. You are, when you are thinking about a strategy for organizational resilience, focusing on property, that is a facility, it doesn't make sense for most companies to have a backup site that they never use. It is a sunk cost. It is a sunk cost like insurance. In fact, it's not even as good as insurance, because insurance at least will send you back money if you make a claim after a disaster. The recovery site is going to do nothing if you never use it. Instead, is there a way to organize the business that makes a recovery site less necessary, that makes it less likely that the business will tip over all at once, and that provides an advantage over a business's competitors? And I think I've been able to find some for some of my clients, perhaps not enough. There are more. And I find that an executive to whom you speak in those terms says, well, he's not just trying to get me to spend money to comply with a standard or a regulatory requirement. He's trying to get me to think about how can I spend this money that will both achieve organizational resilience and give us some advantage that we can monetize every day.
Yeah, look, I agree. I've had exactly the same experience talking to senior executives where you can use their asset, their capability in more than one way. And you're right, that gives them value for money. So how do we change this practice to address some of these other issues? Is it skills? I mean, your current work with trying to teach people better persuasion skills, is it practitioners having better grounding in business, like being accountability for profit, being more entrepreneurial? What do we have to do to change this?
Well, I think I said in the article that you quoted about what's wrong with contingency planning, it's both a range of skills and a range of consequences. So, if you will, to make it more memorable, it's addressing a wider range of causes of disasters and a wider range of consequences of disasters. So, yes, I think everybody in any profession should be thinking about expanding his or her skill set. I think the example that we talked about at the outset, where I forced myself to go and learn something about emergency management when I felt that business continuity management was not enough. I think there are plenty of skills that people in resilience professions can learn. I encourage people just to start, go to a conference in a related profession to which you've never been before. At least meet some new people, expand your mind. And that addresses the skill side. The causes side, I think that thought leadership in organizational resilience means thinking about risks that may not yet be obvious, that may not come on quickly, that we may not have thought about yet, but where I live, Ken, you can't open the newspaper any day of the week, not any day of the week, without seeing something about the weather or water, and every other day about food security. And I think that those are the kinds of consequential issues that people in our professions must start thinking about. I'm going to devote the rest of my career to hammering, beating away on that drum, and I hope I get somewhere.
Absolutely. I hope you do too. And I'm glad you brought up the term thought leadership, because it was actually trying to wrestle with that concept that motivated me to start this podcast in the first place. Because so many times you read what is allegedly thought leadership or what it's supposed to be, and frankly, it's become not much more than marketing and in some perspectives. And you wrote a really good piece, might have actually been one of the first things of yours I came across, about thought leadership. And yeah, it's got some wonderful analogies. You know, thought leadership is about bumblebee cross fertilizing in an orchard. But more importantly, it talks about, again, I'm just going to quote from it, a thought leader articulates thoughts you haven't yet had, perceives conceptual relationships you do not see, and has flashes of insight you wished you'd had. He challenges orthodoxy, sees a different future, and describes it to you in ways that make you believe. Now, great prose absolutely aligns with the kind of risks and threats you were just speaking about. So you obviously still see thought leadership in that way?
I see it exactly as I wrote it in the passage that you just quoted. That passage didn't make me any friends over at the BCI, to whom I referred to or compared to Jeeves and Wooster in the old British comedy. I don't think that thought leadership is arguing about whether business impact analysis comes before risk analysis or risk analysis comes before business impact analysis. The Americans think that risk analysis comes first. The BCI, the Brits, think that impact analysis comes first. That's not thought leadership. That's how many angels are there on the head of a pin. Thought leadership is, thought leadership asks the question, are we doing it right? And I'd be suspicious of anybody who says, yeah, we're doing it right, because I think we're still pushing, I think we're still addressing the same questions fundamentally about how to motivate people that we were addressing 20 years ago.
Yeah, I'm hoping that out of all of this, we can come to the conclusion that thought leadership is actually leading us to think rather than telling people what they should be thinking.
What I learned about education when I went to university was how to examine a thought or a statement or a belief critically, not antagonistically, but critically, how to think about it for myself. And maybe that's the meaning of a liberal arts education. I'm sure that the university I went to would like to think so. I think that approach in my life has, I think, served me pretty well. It has quite often not made me any friends. I don't think that the people at DRI or BCI are great fans of mine. I'm happy to do the work they're doing. I'm a member. I pay my dues. But what they do by themselves isn't going to make any organization in the world resilient. And following ISO 22301 isn't going to make any organization resilient. What is going to be make people resilient is awareness and action. And to get them to be aware and to take action, you have to persuade them. And we have not, we in my profession and I have not yet succeeded in doing that. And it may be a fool's errand.
Well, maybe not a, I think there's a whole bunch of skills that we need to develop, and the ability to persuade and influence people is one that we've overlooked. So let me take that as a segue to looking into the future. The show's called Beyond the Black Stump, which, as you're probably aware, an Australian colloquial expression about the looking beyond the known universe, the uncharted waters. And I'm suspecting a lot of what we've spoken about today is going to put many of our colleagues outside their comfort zones, which is another aspect of it. In 2011, you wrote about the BC profession being a dead end. And again, I'll quote, hope they'll be happy doing the same thing.
And that's 4 years ago.
It was 2011, I think. That's a few years back.
Seems like only yesterday. Okay.
Well, the interesting part would be, let's hope it's not actually accurate about tomorrow. I mean, you said they'll be happy doing the same thing in 2020 because I just can't see many of them moving up the corporate org chart. There may be exceptions, but I think they only prove the rule. Now, you went on to say you interview people for BC jobs, and when you ask that old hoary chestnut, where do you see yourself in 5 years, we don't necessarily have an answer. And one of the things that I've been spending a bit of time on over the past 12 months is actually asking that question of people about how do they see business continuity in 2020, which is only 5 years away. So let me put you on the spot. How do you see, can you describe a day in the life of a BC professional in 2020? Who do you think they'll be talking to, and what do you think they'll be talking about?
Well, I like to think that whatever I'll be doing in 2020 will, at least in some part, be in Asia and be about Asia, which I have loved and still love. I felt at home there, and I want to continue to be there as often as I can. I think that I like to think that my life in 2020 will be a bit like my life today. I spend a lot of time reading, I spend a lot of time talking to a small number of people in this profession who I know for sure are smarter than I am, who are thinking about the future, who are actively asking what are we doing wrong and trying to correct it. And I get, if there's one thing that I get more joy from than speaking, it's writing. And so I intend to continue trying to teach and speak and write. And if I'm able to still do that in 2020 and have people like you call me up from the other side of the world and start quoting to me, I will think that I have had some small success.
Look, I'm sure you had more than one hit on most of those articles, so there are probably other people reading them too. You've hit on a subject that's quite a hobby horse of mine, reading. It's something that I regularly find at conferences and whatnot, people saying to me, oh, we don't have time for that, or all we read is, you know, narrow industry publications.
Yeah.
You teach, I was going to say presentations, but you teach persuasion as a skill to people. How critical is reading and even being able to practice writing to being able to persuade?
I was an English major at university, and the one thing that I learned is that you can't write unless you read. Because you can't learn how to do it right unless you read people who do it wrongly and people who do it beautifully. And so I have way more things to read on my Kindle than I'm ever going to have a chance to read. It's the equivalent of the, it's the electronic equivalent of the bedside stand. But as I look over that the list of books that are there to read, they cover a wide range of subjects. They're generally by authors whose work I do not know. They're on subjects, I confess, there's a lot about water and there's a lot about food and some about climate. And I don't know how you can possibly advance in any career unless you're trying to learn something new. And there's a limited number of ways to do that, but the cheapest one is reading.
Yeah, I'm you're probably preaching to the choir. I think we're kindred spirits there. I also have a Kindle that's loaded with stuff that I've yet to get around to reading. And I, like you, I guess I read a lot as well.
We need some more long plane trips between Asia and North America. 18 hours each way gives me plenty of time to read without a phone ringing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a couple of those coming up over coming months. Look, Nat, it's been great speaking with you. I'm not sure where our paths are going to cross next. I really hope people take away this idea of the need to read more. I'm thinking that that might actually be the key to read more, to read wider, to actually change that narrow focus of the risks that we're trying to address.
I will confess one secret. For the last 5 years, I did not own a television set. So when people ask, well, how do you find time to do all that reading? I said, because I don't do any watching of television or movies. I've probably missed some important cultural events, but it's certainly been quieter not having a TV.
That's an interesting perspective. That's probably a whole different conversation for another day. We'll probably... I spoke to Luke Bird just recently, another interview for the show, who I think you've had some correspondence with.
Sure.
Interesting young man talking about how people are coming into this industry now direct from college and choosing it as a career, not falling in accidentally. And sometimes that generation probably couldn't possibly conceive of how you live without television and social media, but it does give me faith that we can change things when people are actively choosing this work and wanting to come here.
Look, Ken, I'm delighted that you're doing these podcasts, and I'm flattered to be asked and happy that technology makes it possible for us to do this.
It does indeed.
I look forward to getting a link or something that I'll get to listen to whatever I said.
Oh, you certainly will. And Nat, again, thanks for your time, and hope our paths cross sometime soon in the future.
I do, as I do as well. You have a good day.
You too.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the three episodes available for today, launch day. As always, I would really appreciate it if you took a few minutes to go over to iTunes, leave a rating, review, or comment. And you're also welcome to come and join the conversation on our LinkedIn community. Until next week, take care on your resilience journey.